Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is author Teresa Fraser. She is the author of the new therapeutic children's book, Billy Had to Move. Teresa has worked in children's mental health in Canada since 1983. She has supported children in her role as child and youth worker, therapeutic foster parent resource worker, and now therapist. She is also a part-time professor at Mohawk College in a child and youth worker program. Her first book is entitled Billy Had to Move, and she hopes to publish other bibliotherapy books that will help children in the future. Teresa and her husband have fostered children over the last 20 years. They now have 6 children ranging in age from 7 to 20 years of age. And Teresa's personal website, where you can find all sorts of information, is teresafraser.com. So welcome, Teresa, to the program today.
Oh, thank you, Juanita. It's so nice to be here.
Yeah, so I want to just congratulate you on publishing your first book. Sounds like you have more in the works.
Oh, well, yes, I have stories that I've used with children in therapy over the last 5 years, and Billy Had to Move just seemed to be like kind of the one that would be the best one to see if it was would be helpful to other children and therapists. So that kind of is the first one published. So we'll see how helpful it is for service providers and children.
Mm-hmm. It's been out now for a few months.
Yes,
it's getting great recommendations.
Oh, thank you. And the feedback from child and youth workers and therapists both in Canada and the U.S. has been very exciting and encouraging for me, and also from children as well.
Yeah.
That have read the book. And I think also some credit goes to the illustrator Alex Walton, because his pictures, they're true-to-life pictures of and not cartoon kind of caricatures of Billy, which children have said to me that that helps them feel like this could be their story too.
Mm-hmm. There's a realism to it.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you connect with the illustrator? How did you two work together?
Oh, it was such a privilege to work with Alex. Actually, when Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press had stated that he was excited to publish this book, he had a couple illustrators in mind that when I had contacted them, they had other projects on the go. So Alex came highly recommended by another illustrator, and Alex actually is another Canadian. He is located in Kamloops, British Columbia, and when he isn't illustrating books, and for theater companies, he does. His website is quite interesting too, with samples of his work.
Oh.
My understanding is he's a firefighter.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
Have you ever met face to face?
No.
Yeah.
Face to face, lots of phone calls, and the internet is such a wonderful thing.
Yes. Yes.
I sent the story to him, and he said immediately, "Oh, this is a project I really want to be involved in," and it began from there.
Fantastic. So tell our audience today, what exactly is the genre of bibliotherapy? What is a bibliotherapy book?
Well, a bibliotherapy book can be used by teachers or child and youth workers or foster parents or therapists, kind of a slice of life book that can help children recognize themes that they're also experiencing in their life, but it's externalizing their difficulties. So in this particular book, I really wanted Billy to enter foster care for some of the other reasons that children enter foster care in Canada, the U.S. I mean, we all hear of stories in the news where kids have been abused or neglected, but also there's situations, as in Billy's case, where his grandmother, who is his care provider, dies, and his mother is, the book kind of infers that mom has had some difficulties and is nowhere around, unfortunately. So because he has no family members or extended family members, he then enters foster care.
Mm-hmm.
That I felt was kind of important for children, because for children that aren't touched by foster care, or families or adults that don't really have an understanding of all the many reasons children come into foster care, that kind of was a theme that I wanted to address in this book, in addition to the many others.
Mm-hmm. Well, what initially led to this work, being a foster parent and then becoming involved with children's mental health?
Oh, that's such a great question.
Yeah.
Personally, when my sister and I were very little, our mother was ill and our parents were quite young. And because my mother needed to be in the hospital for an extended period of time, we entered into the foster care system here in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on when my mother was healthy and we were reunited with our family in years to come, they decided they wanted to give something back and they became foster parents as well. Mm-hmm. So as you know, I've grown up with foster care in some aspect of my life since I was a little person. And then after graduating from high school, I really felt strongly that I wanted to work with families who are experiencing struggles. So I entered in Canada, we have a program called the Child and Youth Worker Program at community colleges. And in the States, they're often called youth workers.
Mm-hmm.
And these are professionals that work with kids in schools or group homes or institutions or in foster homes, to help focusing on emotional and behavioral challenges to help them be more successful in their many life spaces. And then when my husband and I were married, we had our first son and we knew we wanted to have a large family, and we were approached to operate an adolescent treatment foster home group home,
mm-hmm.
which was really wonderful because our oldest son, who's now 20, really grew up with lots of adolescent siblings.
Oh my God.
And was really exposed to different cultures and faith groups, and we're very proud of the person he's become.
Mm-hmm.
So foster care has touched our lives at so many different times in my life, and also touched my family's life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Well, can you pinpoint anything specifically about your experience as a foster child that, your emotional journey that you really remember?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the feedback that I've gotten from other clinicians around Billy Had to Move as a story is that I try and depict in the book observations that the child would have. Like
mm-hmm.
instead of when he's first called down from his classroom to the office to meet the social worker, instead of being able to hear what the social worker has to say, he's looking at the social worker's shoes and wondering how old he was when he learned how to tie his shoes. And I remember as a little person not understanding that my mother was sick and couldn't look after us, but not quite understanding, you know, why we had to live in this house, or not understanding new families' rules. I remember one foster home, they wouldn't let us wear our socks to bed. And that was something our mother let us do. And that was really such an upsetting factor for a four-year-old. And as adults, sometimes those little experiences that kids have, we don't realize, I think, how important they are to connecting them with their home experience.
Mm-hmm.
So in Billy Had to Move, I tried to give a lot of examples of a child's perspective on the experiences of moving to a new home and meeting new adults that were helpers. And, of course, Billy wonders, you know, what in all of this is his fault and if he's a bad kid,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is kind of a natural question that kids have when adult experiences are going on around them. So in the book, I tried to give lots of examples of that. And I've had other therapists say, wow, that was really helpful.
Yeah.
Not only for myself, but for the child that I was working with, because it helped to normalize their experience.
It's so interesting that as adults, we think we know what kids are thinking and feeling, but really in actuality, we don't.
Oh, so true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's so true. And as a therapist, that's why play therapy as an intervention is so powerful for children, because as adults, we can often talk about how we're feeling and what we're experiencing. And children, it takes them a long time to trust, and sometimes a long time to come to terms with actually how they are feeling. Their initial feeling or fear about moving somewhere may be, I didn't take my library books back, where the adults in the child's life are thinking, you know, they must be so upset about having this change happen or that change happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so important for adults and play therapists in our mode of providing treatment. We do a lot of listening and watching and going at the child's pace.
Well, tell us what exactly is a play therapist and how you incorporated that type of therapy in this book.
Well, play therapy has been around since the beginning of the century, and in the United States, there is the Association for Play Therapy, and that your listeners could look that up on the web. And in Canada, we have the Canadian Association of Child and Play Therapists, and there is also a website for that organization. A play therapist is someone who has a really strong, good foundation in child psychology and counseling, and then focuses in further training to identify how tools such as books, puppets, dollhouses can help provide the words for a child to express how they're feeling about what they're experiencing in their life. I also am certifying in Santre therapy, and Santre therapy has been around for over 100 years. It started off, it's really quite interesting, the same author that brought us War of the Worlds also wrote a book called Floor Play.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book that talked about his playing with his sons on the main floor of their house, and they had no furniture in the house, and he really identified, I think there's a quote from the book that says, "The jolliest of floor games helps boys become men," really believing that children work out their issues and learn and grow through play.
Mm-hmm.
So Santre therapy really is an extension of that, in that miniatures are brought into a sand tray with sand and or water, and children can externalize what experiences they're having into the sand tray. Actually, the book, I have to correct, it's not Floor Play, it's Floor Game.
Floor Game, that's right, that's right.
I
you know, I've heard so much about the whole sand tray therapy. It is so powerful, and I wonder if, especially in today's age where kids don't play as much as they used to, you know, a lot of kids are just put in front of a TV and their play is through video games or that type of thing. So this work is really, really powerful and very necessary.
Yeah, and very powerful for adults as well as couples and groups. I use Santre if I do a lot of workshops and training of not only foster parents but social workers in different locations, and we may start off with a Santre experience as a group,
or I
lecture at some local universities, and the students will come out and say, "Oh my gosh, I need to learn more about this."
Oh wow!
And it is pretty powerful, and often it doesn't require a lot of introduction with children. Not surprisingly, a child will walk into my office and they'll see the miniatures on the shelves and they'll say, "Hey, I can make a world with those things in the sand tray."
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, "Yeah, absolutely, you can." And then off they go.
So do you have to use that kind of play therapy in a therapeutic setting, or is this something that a parent can learn to do and work with their children?
You know what? Absolutely. I mean, obviously, for the sand tray therapy becoming certified, it's been a 6-year process with Dr. D. Domenico, who works out of California. However, I would encourage all parents, child and youth workers, foster parents, you can learn so much about what your child is experiencing by just watching them play. And sometimes when we're playing with our children, we put on our educational hats and start to provide information or facts. And really just sitting and listening and mirroring what the child is saying can encourage them to be comfortable to talk about what else is going on for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have to be done with a sand tray. It can be done just with toys on the floor and not trying to fill in the gaps. I think sometimes as parents we feel this big push to be teaching our children and, you know, making sure they're going to get good grades and providing them with all the world information we think they need. And really, if we just kind of go at their pace and listen and support them, they're going to bring us into their world, and we're going to learn a lot about what their perceptions of situations are.
So do you think ask more questions?
Actually, not so much ask more questions, just actually listen and be attentive.
Mm-hmm.
And if a child is saying in their play, for example, you know, the little boy wants to get to the top of the mountain, instead of saying, "Why does he want to get to the top of the mountain?" just saying, "Yeah, the little boy does want to get to the top of the mountain."
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes an open-ended story that the child then will continue sharing more information about.
So just sort of encourage the dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So you are considered a therapeutic foster parent. So how is that different from just a regular foster parent?
Oh, what a great question. In Canada, we have therapeutic foster parents, and not to diminish the role of a regular foster parent because they do wonderful work, but in Canada, a therapeutic foster parent is expected to, often they're coming to the work with a diploma in child and youth work, or they may be a nurse. They have also a professional designation, and if not, they've participated in a lot of ongoing training regarding trauma and attachment. So, and that's really, really important, because with kids who've experienced trauma and kids that have experienced multiple caregivers or had experiences in their life that have interfered with their parent-child bond attachment, behaviorally they can present, they can be very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And for foster parents that don't recognize that the behavior really is more an example of needs and that behavior management doesn't necessarily work. It's more about setting the child up for success in the environment. It's really important that, so therapeutic foster parents do lots of training and education in that area.
Why do you think it is that all foster parents aren't in this therapeutic foster model? I mean, that really seems to be the correct way to do this.
Yeah, it always comes back down to funding and supports and resources. And in the United States, every state has their own model in terms of service provision, and the same holds true in Canada and different provinces. Yeah, absolutely. I really strongly believe all of that training is required for anyone who's providing service to special needs kids. And in my work with kids, I may be working with a child, but I also think it's really important to work with a family and really believe that my work is only supporting what they're doing in the home. So it's really, I find it's really important to connect with whoever the primary caregiver is, whether it's a kinship placement like a grandparent or another family member or a foster parent, and kind of explain the whole trauma and attachment, all the theory behind that, because, you know, I just...
They're traumatized.
And it shows up. I had a meeting with a high school teacher a couple weeks ago where this 14-year-old boy is, you know, she's perceiving him to be very defiant and almost bordering on aggressive. And then when I talked about the effect that, you know, that domestic violence had on his life from 0 to 6, it was like a light bulb went off in her head, and she went, oh. You mean I could be approaching him in a way that he feels threatened, and then that's precipitating that response? Yeah, absolutely. So that kind of supportive team information sharing is, I think, just can only help kids be successful.
So what other ways, besides the aggressive or acting out behavior, what are other ways that this might show up with children?
For kids who've had lots of trauma and lots of attachment disruptions, I mean, they can present in a variety of different ways, and it can be from one end of the spectrum where they don't trust that adults are going to meet their needs in any way, shape, or form, to the where they would have an ambivalent attachment, to the other end when perhaps they have an anxious attachment where they're just going to be, you know, right beside that adult all the time because they don't trust the adult's going to follow through on promises. That can be the most exhausting. Those can be kind of the most exhausting behaviors for a foster parent to manage, because, you know, if a child's been in their home for 5 years and they'll say, you know, every day we have dinner at 5:30, but every day at 5:20, you know, I have the child going, when's dinner coming? Is it going to be here today? And what are we going to be eating? Those kind of day-to-day challenges can be very exhausting for a foster parent if they don't understand, you know, the reason that child at 5:20 is really getting anxious about whether dinner's on the table is because they were left in a room for 3 days and didn't eat when they were little. Those early experiences really, we know scientifically now, if you look at, if you're listeners look to the work of Dr. Bruce Perry, and his website is childtrauma.org, and he has some wonderful information around how these kids, their brains are wired differently, and that wiring really impedes their day-to-day functioning. So it's really up to everyone who's supporting and working with them to learn as much as they can and provide the supports and adapt the environments to help the kids.
And that wiring, that is, will be changed with those kids for the rest of their life. So they do need to learn the skills when they're young.
Absolutely, yeah. And in Billy's case, there's an inference in the book that he has experienced some other early experiences by the fact that his mom isn't around and he doesn't know where she is. But he isn't displaying a lot of the behaviors that I've addressed. It's just kind of a real entry-level book for kids. I mean, I wrote it primarily for kids so that adults who are working with them can read it to them and say, you know what, you know, you're not the only one that's gone into a foster home, and, you know, here's some of the fears he had. I bet you have some of those. And also, here are some of the support people that want to help you to make this experience, you know, less traumatic for you.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Teresa Fraser. She is the author of Billy Had to Move, and you can find out more about Teresa and her book through her website, teresafraser.com. You know, it's interesting you brought the whole idea of Billy going to his grandparents, and you know, we wouldn't typically think that kids would develop attachment or behavioral problems with just moving into another family setting.
Yeah.
But it's there.
Oh, totally. Sometimes I'll equate it with foster parents. Just say to them, you know, how would you like it if one day someone showed up and said, you know what, you're not going to be married to this man anymore. We've decided it'd be better to put you with this person in this house, and here's your new life, and here's your new room, and, you know, here's the food that they like to eat, and, you know, these are the rules that this family uses to operate, and, you know, I'll come back in 7 days and see how you're doing. And then the adults go, oh, and it's like, that's exactly what it's like for a little person, except they may not even be able to self-advocate or ask the questions.
Yeah.
So most child protection workers really have a handle on that and recognize that kids are going to have some really common questions. So when children are placed, they go through, you know, this is where the bathroom is, and this is where, you know, kids eat every day here.
Mm-hmm.
Go through those really kind of common concerns that kids have,
mm-hmm.
and then try to develop a connection with them, and then do return to say, hey, how are things going, and what, you know, what are the things you still might be worried about? And in this particular book, that's why we, at the end, we brought in a child and play therapist, because the helping adults recognized that Billy was experiencing some anxiety symptoms around the changes in his life, like headaches and tummy aches. Physical symptoms of anxiety.
Yeah.
So he was then referred to a play therapist, and that part of the story then began.
Yeah. How does the play therapy actually relieve that anxiety? Is it something that the kids just figure out for themselves? Are they getting more in touch with their emotions? How does that actually work?
Oh, that's a great question, because it's different for every child depending on what the precipitating reasons are for them to be coming to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But often therapy addresses some common goals, such as a place for the child to express their feelings, a safe adult that they can develop a therapeutic alliance with and feel comfortable with over time. Often in therapy, we help kids figure out strategies that can decrease some of those symptoms,
mm-hmm.
as well as then help the adults that are involved in the child's life recognize when the child is experiencing those symptoms and, you know, provide those extra supports in before the child even may themselves realize that they need them. You know, as time goes on, and depending on the age of the child and depending on what their trauma history is, the work can be, you know, non-directive as compared to directive. And non-directive work would be initially, as in the story with Billy, where he just came into the room and explored the room. And my experience with kids when I'm working with them non-directively is that whatever the issue is, it shows up in their play.
Mm-hmm.
Always. I just, as the adult, have to be patient and wait.
You don't have to hear it. Yeah.
No, I don't have to hear it. You can see it. And then when they're starting to express that in their play, then the therapist is aware of their history and recognizes the signs and the cues, and then helps the child recognize that they're and develop some strategies and coping strategies to problem solve whatever the issue is at the time.
That must be such rewarding work to be involved in.
It's such a privilege.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I have to tell you, sometimes with children, depending on what their history is, it can take them a long time to get to the point where they start to feel safe enough to express how they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've sat on the chair in the therapy room and looked and thought, you know, what could I be doing differently, or what am I not doing? And I really need to trust the play therapy process, because always, 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 when the child's ready and in their time frame, the issues start to arise,
mm-hmm.
and they start to show the adults around them that they're ready to hear and receive support.
So
it is. It's really exciting. It's really just wonderful. It's a privilege.
And so even when it seems like nothing's really happening, there is a process still unfolding.
Well, I had another example with a gal I've worked with for about a year, and in the sand tray, she kept creating conflict in the sand tray, and kids were bullying other kids, and I was trying to get a sense of what's that all about, and then her social worker called me and said, you know, I went to a school meeting, and for a month, she's been picking on other kids, and then all of a sudden, it stopped.
Oh, God.
I was like, oh, do you know anything about that? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, because she didn't identify that was herself, but in the sand tray, she was working that stuff out in terms of, it was the bullying was the theme, but it was also not knowing how to connect with and make friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the second part of the process. Once she did, you know, did the bullying stuff, then she was able to work it out, and it transferred into her life. And
mm-hmm.
that was just, I was, and at the time, I have to admit, I was thinking, what's this about? And then it became evident exactly what it was about. So children will play out what they need to play out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate, both in Canada and the U.S., that there's kind of a belief that in 10 to 12 sessions sometimes, you know, it can get fixed. And the reality is that sometimes, depending on the child and their history and their ability to trust, sometimes it takes a little bit longer than 12 sessions.
Yeah, sure.
So it's that patience in being setting the sessions and being available to the child as consistently as we can.
So clearly it is really important for you to be dialoguing with other people in the kid's family.
I try as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
yeah, to work as part of a treatment team
mm-hmm.
while still respecting the child's confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. So with this book, Billy Had to Move, what actually is the age group?
Well, that's a really great question, too. Thank you so much, because I had one reviewer say, you know, how is this book going to be used for older kids when Billy's only 7? And Billy is only 7, but mm-hmm. I've used this story with kids as young as 6 up to 10 or 11. And 12 even, because they were able to look back and go, actually, I had a couple of adolescents too when I think about it, because they were able to, when I went through pieces of it, they were able to say, that was like what it was like for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it, again, externalized their own issues into another individual who is Billy. So it isn't the kind of book that we would expect a child to pick up and just read. And I had a parent reviewer say, oh my gosh, it was hard for me to go through, you know, read all of the experiences he had because I've never been touched by this. And exactly, that's absolutely true. It's more appropriate for an adult to read to a child, which is why we would call it a bibliotherapy book.
Mm-hmm.
I also would hope, though, that school libraries would have a copy in their library just so people in the school community can recognize what it's like for kids to be in foster care, because foster care touches, in Canada, there's at least 80,000 children in foster care.
Is that right?
And I'm not sure what the statistics are in the States, but foster care touches many, many, many people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the more people who can have a little bit more of an understanding of what that's like for a child to move into a foster home, it's just going to be a bigger payoff, not only for the child, but for the community as a whole.
I imagine that an adult that went through a foster system would also probably find some sort of therapeutic benefit for themselves reading this book, because it does touch on so many common issues.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would think
so. That's really the hope. Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that because there's a variety of themes in the book, it's not the kind of book that you necessarily have to read from page one to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had clinicians say, you know what, I had a child who lost their grandmother,
mm-hmm.
and in the story, Billy's grandmother dies, and that's why he goes into foster care. So she said, though that child wasn't going into foster care, I just read the section around loss of the grandmother,
mm-hmm.
and it was really helpful. And that's exactly why I set it up the way it is. So you can pick out the parts that are applicable or read the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the book, there's a caregiver guide with some ideas of further resources if parents are looking for more information, including websites in addition to my own.
Oh, fantastic. So with so many multiple messages, is there one specific overriding message of this book?
I think it's the old adage that we all believe in, it takes a community to raise a child.
Mm.
You know, it isn't just a foster parent, it isn't just a social worker or a teacher or a principal, it's also a therapist. And the character that we haven't kind of talked about up to this point is that the person who he joined with first in the foster family was the family's baby, and her acceptance and love and welcoming approach for him
mm-hmm.
helped him feel comfortable enough to go, okay, this is an okay place to be.
Oh, wow.
I think that would be the message that I would want people to walk away with. That it takes many, many people to support children.
Mhm. Mhm. Well, what are some of the other ways that a foster family can actually make it easier?
Well, things like, and in my own experience, my husband and I have fostered for 20 years, so we have children that we hope will stay with us until they're men.
Yeah. Have all of your children stayed with you, or have some of them?
No, initially, when we started fostering 20 years ago and we had our son who was an infant, we fostered adolescents, and we ran a program where kids really had nowhere else to go, and the agency was trying to figure out what would be the best situation to meet their needs.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be with us for at least 60 days, and I would do an assessment and kind of assess, you know, if it's a foster home, what kind of foster home, if it's group care, mm-hmm. because some kids, you know, have their family and there's no way they can accept living in another family.
Mm-hmm.
So a group care situation, you know, is more respective of their needs and where they're at. And then there were some kids who had some pretty significant mental health issues and needed a mental health program where it wasn't just a group care program, but there were lots of therapies on site every day. So those kids know the children that had the most struggle stayed with us longer because it was tougher to find a long-term placement for them. But we've only been fostering long-term for the last 10 years. So not all the children that we fostered over the years have stayed with us, but many keep in touch. And I'm a foster grandmother, too, which is kind of exciting.
Oh, wow.
And, and the boys we have now, we have three boys long-term, and they've been with us minimum 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And my husband he's a stay-at-home foster parent. So a treatment foster parent in Canada needs to be at home and available all the time. So because the kids often have many medical appointments and or, you know, school issues may be prevalent, so they may be suspended lots, so there needs to be a parent there to support them at home.
Mm-hmm.
So with our guys, my husband's a stay-at-home parent, and I'm the person that works outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And they, the things that we try to do and then that I encourage with other foster parents that I work with are things like family photos. So kids are getting the message, you're part of this family. You know, forever, for as long as you're here with us, we love you and you're going to be part of this family.
Mm-hmm.
My husband's really amazing with all the photos that we take. He put them on a stick and then got a media player with music. So, you know, when someone's having a hard day, he'll just, without even saying too much, just put their pictures up of all the fun things they've done in the last year.
And
just really, you know, empowering and very positive for the kids.
Yeah.
And then giving kids messages like, you know, next year when it's your birthday, we're going to have to remember that you really like tacos or that you really enjoyed this, and we'll do this again next year. So really talking in the future with kids so that they get the message that, you know, we want you here and there's permanency here, which can be kind of a struggle sometimes when your goal is also to help the child reunite with their biological family.
Mm.
And Billy kind of experienced that in the book, too, where kids sometimes have their feet in two houses. It's like, I really like living here, but I really miss my bio family as well. So therapeutic foster parents are also trained in how to be really inclusive and support the biological parents. And when we had kids who had contact with their bio parents, I would invite moms to come over and help me make dinner or teach me a family recipe, because that really gives the kids a message that your mom is as appreciated here as you are. And in Canada, Mother's Day has been recently occurred. So with our kids, we made sure at dinner time when we said grace that we honored, you know, there's a lot of mothers probably thinking about you guys today. And we want, you know, let's keep them in our hearts, that even though they're not able to be with you, that, you know, we're thinking good thoughts to them too.
I think that is such a powerful way to really interact with these children, and that is really the therapeutic model. I mean, I think all foster parents should be taught this.
Oh, I think there's so many already doing it.
Oh,
but yeah,
good.
It's a good reminder sometimes.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So when a foster child actually reaches legal age, which I imagine is 18, I'm not too sure, so do they get support, financial, mental, emotional? What's for them at that point in that age?
Well, it depends on where you are geographically, and there's different states in the U.S. have different protocols, and the same is true in Canada. In where I live in Ontario, at 18, kids are able to go out on their own, and then from 18 to 21, there's support given for housing and university. And the Ontario government in the last year, actually the last year, has just come out with, if a child was a Crown ward, in other words, a long-term foster child and a ward of the state, that they, you know, get a college loan quite easily, because there's recognition that they don't have a biological family able to support them in obtaining post-secondary education.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some resources there, not enough.
Yeah.
It's changing, it's getting better. The other thing that I'm acutely aware of as a therapist and as a foster parent is that if at all possible at 18, these kids want to reunite with their biological families. So, and why wouldn't they? So as much as possible throughout their life, if there is the opportunity to not only have contact but do treatment and provide treatment and support to those families, that makes a lot of sense. And in my role, I'm really lucky, the agency that I work at, that I get to work with some bio families that only have visitation with their kids, and I'll meet with them around how can we make your visits better and it be encouraging the parent-child bond, because even though they don't live with you, they're still your children. And when they're adults, they're probably going to come back to you. So those issues that were issues that precipitated them coming into care, you know, need to still be addressed because they will raise their head later on in life as well. So there are supports available with, we hope with our kids that they'll continue living at home. that's the hope, but we'll have to see. You know, we have to then also say to them, we're always going to be here. Just like our 20-year-old who doesn't live at home right now. He's moved out on his own and changed jobs, and he's back home for a week before he moves into his new apartment. And I think that's a good message to the younger kids. You can go away, but when you need to come home for a bit, we're here.
This is home.
Yeah, this is home for you. This is home base. So we're hoping that'll be the same experience that our kids have. Yeah.
So it's such fascinating work, and you obviously just love what you do so much, and you really are changing lives, Teresa. Really.
Thank you, but not alone, I have to say, Juanita. And if, you know, thanks to Victor Volkman at Loving Healing Press and Alex Walton in supporting Billy Had to Move to become a published book. Without them, it wouldn't have happened. And then, you know, programs such as Reader Views to be able to get that message out there. I'm so indebted to you as well, because the more people that, you know, the message gets passed on from one person to the next person to the next person. So I hope Billy Had to Move is a story that it helps lots of other children, as not only now but in years to come.
Oh, absolutely. And your future books will obviously help as well. Did you ever think you were going to be a published author?
No. I always dreamed that I would. How that came to be in terms of actually submitting it was, I was invited last year by Charles Schaefer, who's a very well-respected therapist in the States and the president, the original president of the American Play Therapy Association. He invited me to attend an international study group in England last June. And I said, me? Are you sure? Because there's therapists all over the world. And there was a therapist there by the name of Steve Harvey, who's American but works now in New Zealand. And he said, you know, so what is it you want to do? And I said, well, I have books and I'm going to publish someday. And he said, well, have you submitted them? And I said, no. He said, well, what's stopping you? And I said, you know, I don't know, Steve. I guess I just need to do it. And he said, yeah, you really just need to do it. And I came back from that trip in early July, sent my manuscript to Victor, and the same day he emailed me back and said, I have to publish this book. And I was like, oh my gosh, I feel so grateful. Like, thank you so much.
So, no kidding.
Yeah, it was a really positive experience.
Oh, wow. So what is your next project? Have you nailed that down?
Well, at this point, what I'm trying to do is just kind of let school libraries and associations here in Canada know that Billy Had to Move is in existence, because it's great to write a book, but if people don't know it's out there, and in Canada there's been very few books written about play therapy and foster care in the last 15 years.
Oh, yeah, this is a new field.
It's kind of a really new thing, and I also am a professor at a community college, as you noted at the beginning of our interview, so I'm hoping that there'll be some community colleges that say, hey, this is a book that we want students to have, and it'll be put on the required reading list. So then the message will, if my dream would be that child and youth workers would have books such as Billy Had to Move in their toolkits, and then when they need to use them with kids, they have them. So right now, I guess my short-term goals are to kind of let people know that this book is in existence, and hopefully it'll be shared, you know, with one person and then the next person and the next person, and we'll go from there.
So
one step at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole promotion aspect of a book is a huge endeavor. So I understand that's where your energy is focused. Well, it's so well received. I mean, really, and this is such a necessary book that I can't imagine that you're going to have any problem. I mean, people are going to be wanting your next project.
Oh, thank you so much. You're so encouraging.
Yeah.
It really does take a community to support adults, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's so true. Well, let's mention your website. It's teresafraser.com. And what can we find up there?
Well, there's more information about what Billy Had to Move, and then comments from therapists in North America and Canada. I also have, in addition to providing play therapy and working with families and doing education with foster parents, I do a lot of workshops with other clinicians. So I've listed workshops that I have done in various communities. And it's still under construction because I want to have a little bit of a section about what Santray World Play is and where individuals can seek more training and get more information on it, because that probably is my most preferred modality in working with individuals. So it's a beginning of a website as well. And I hope I also have my email address on the website. So if individuals want further information or have questions, they're more than welcome to give me, you know, send me an email, and I'll happily respond and share resources or ideas. So, yeah.
Great.
Thanks so much for asking about that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, so you are up in Canada, but you must be very familiar with the whole U.S. foster system. What are the major differences you see?
Well, I think one major difference that you folks are way ahead of us on is that whenever I go to the States for training or workshops, I see lots of advertisements for adoption of adolescents. And in Canada, adoption is really supported and encouraged up to kids around 10 or 11. And then that kind of thinking is, once kids are at that age, they're not really interested in becoming part of a family. And yet in the States, I know that's not true. So I think that will, that belief and philosophy will filter over to us at some point as well. So that's very exciting. But I think in the States, just like in Canada, you know, every geographical area struggles with legislation in terms of protecting children and resources in terms of what's available. So it's really important for anyone that's involved in the field, whether it's a foster parent or a social worker or a protection worker or a therapist, to always be looking at the gaps and advocating and speaking up about what we want to make our system better. Because it's not a perfect system. It's a flawed system. But it's really made up of people that I believe are doing their absolute best to provide the best service to kids. And we're only involved in this work because we believe in it so strongly. So it's good to be providing the work, but we also need to be speaking up and sharing ideas.
Well, in your opinion, what do you think is the area that needs the most improvement?
I would really, really love to see more programs that are available to be supporting biological parents in terms of treatment and in terms of counseling, and more specific programs that help biological parents and foster parents work together. And I believe there's the motivation and the interest to make that happen, but there needs to be the resources made available to make that happen, because the kids will end up being the winners in the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's interesting that the most improvement that you feel needs to be with the adults.
Yeah. Absolutely.
They're an important part of the equation here.
Yeah. And at the early stages. So hopefully we can prevent kids coming into care.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's always the wish. Kids really should be with their biological families wherever possible.
Teresa, it's been so great talking with you today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Yeah, a lot of information, and all the best to you. And I know Billy Had to Move is going to be a great success, and we will just have to have you back when the second book comes out.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
I so appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me here today.
You bet.
And have a great day.
Oh, and you too. Thanks so much. Take care.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.